Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And also thank you to the Family and Friends for Drug Law Reform and the Community Coalition on Corrections for inviting me to speak today. I do come from a fairly ugly brown building in Melbourne, and that's where Annex is based. Annex is an association of organisations that deliver Netherlands syringe programs. Its two principal purposes are to promote evidence-based policy and practice in relation to drugs, i.e. harm reduction, and to promote, therefore, most enthusiastically Netherlands syringe programs. I'd just like to begin by saying a bit of a thanks to some of the people who've assisted in preparing this talk directly or indirectly. Firstly, to Associate Professor Michael Levy, who sent me on some reading journeys, to Avil, who've worked in this area for quite a while and have developed some excellent publications, and also to the Annex staff, David Voon and Amy Kerwin, who did a lot of the work. I basically take responsibility for all the shortcomings, and also have to acknowledge that when you sort of start working on things like this over the weekend, people with good discipline like James Ryan probably don't get distracted, but John Ryan gets distracted, and you find things that, on Google that you never really knew and sort of blow you away. And one of them is the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions. Obviously, occupational health and safety has been a key concern of worker representatives for a very long time. In Australia, a lot of achievements have been made. Westgate Bridge debacle as a high-profile example when it didn't work. But, every day in Australia there are people injured at work. And often, particularly in industries like the building industry, they die. But the global figures are astronomical. The global figure is that over 2 million women and men die each year from unsustainable forms of work, and 160 million more become victims of work-related diseases. So it's an absolute global priority. But also in Australia, it's a national priority, and the national occupational health and safety strategy has been endorsed by all governments across Australian states and territories. The national OH&S strategy goes till 2012 and articulates a shared vision of all Australian governments that work-related death, injury and disease are not inevitable but can be prevented. For those of us in the health sector, the prison setting is commonly perceived as the locus where transmission of bloodborne viruses occurs. It's considered as a health space or an ill health space or a place where we focus on those that are incarcerated. But it's also a workplace and subject to workplace safety laws and regulation. The question that I ponder is, can needle and syringe programs, sometimes called in the prison context needle and syringe exchange programs, I'll continue just using the acronym NSP, can the operation of NSPs contribute to achieving a safer workplace? I believe that it can. We all know that prisons are dangerous places, and we all should acknowledge that working in prisons is very hard work. But before I explain my view further, I'd like to set the scene a little bit and establish some of the background reality of drug use in prisons. And it certainly is true that globally and in all states and territories in Australia, drug use in prisons is a reality. A 2000 report by the Australian Institute of Criminology found that 14% of female prisoners and 10% of male prisoners were incarcerated for drug-related offences as their most serious conviction. The 2004 National Prison Entrance Bloodborne Virus Survey showed that 59% of prison entrants screened had a history of injecting drug use and 38% had injected in the month before entering prison. The Australian Bureau of Crime Intelligence observed in the year 2000 that the demand for drugs is high inside prisons. We all know. And despite a strict prohibitionist approach to drugs, they still find their way into the prison setting. A 2003 survey conducted by Tony Butler and colleagues in New South Wales found that of 789 prisoners from 27 correctional centres in New South Wales, close to half reported a history of injecting drug use. That's about 350 inmates. Of these, close to half reported that they had injected whilst in prison. That's a quarter. That survey is backed up by the Australian NSP survey, which reports that of 254 people in the community attending a needle and syringe program that participated in the survey, 93 of that 254 had been in the prison setting in the preceding 12 months. And of those 93 people, that's a third of everyone that had been in prison, indicated that they had injected while in prison. The response so far has been a concentration on efforts to prevent drugs from entering into prison. Tackling a complex problem with a one single and I think simple approach is bound to fail. The emphasis has traditionally been all about supply control, random and periodic searches of cells and common areas, dog squad search operations of prisoners and staff, high-level entrance security to prevent visitors and new prisoners from bringing contraband items into prison. These are just some of the examples of the security regime that operates in Australian prisons. I believe that the initial resistance to the provision of condoms in Australian prisons included the argument that condoms could be used to hide and smuggle in contraband items such as drugs. Condoms are now provided to prisoners on an anonymous basis in a number of states and territories, and I believe we'll be here. I think that's an achievement of the ACT government that needs to be acknowledged, because whilst they were in New South Wales really as a result of legal action, and they're in other states and territories, they're certainly not in Victoria as we speak. An external evaluation of the trial in WA showed that there was no evidence of condom misuse or inappropriate disposal. They have been, my understanding is, used as a weapon in the New South Wales prison system, and the weapon was a water bomb. I don't consider that to be a significant threat. Despite strategies to control contraband in prison settings, drug use continues to occur and needles and syringes continue to find their way into prisoners' hands. Yet rather than to consider the complementary measures to reduce the harms associated with drug use, the solution continues to be surveillance and control. The Victorian Ombudsman released a report a couple of weeks ago looking at the surveillance and security operation in the Victorian prison system, and reports that more control is required. In fact, quoting the Ombudsman, prison administrators must address this challenge by taking a more vigorous approach to the early detection of illicit drugs, both at entry to a prison and by way of random drug testing and searches. The Australian National Council on Drugs in 2004 commissioned a review of supply, demand and harm reduction strategies in Australian prisons. The review found that supply reduction strategies were widespread, although they were relatively expensive, had not been evaluated and possibly may have unintended negative consequences. The implementation of demand reduction strategies was reasonable, relatively inexpensive and favourably evaluated. However, harm reduction strategies were the least likely to be implemented, even though they were relatively inexpensive and evaluations have been favourable. As we know, there are no NSPs in Australia, and so the evaluations of NSPs are from overseas. This seems to be out of step with the approach to illicit drug use issues in the community, which is based on a comprehensive approach, including demand, supply and harm reduction. Drug use continues to be illegal and most resources in the community are spent on interrupting the supply of illicit drugs into the country or at the local area. Resources are also spent on establishing and providing drug treatment centres. And last but not least, and about 3% of the annual drug budget is the harm reduction component, which includes the needle and syringe program, as well as information and education about the health risks associated with drug use that's available to people who need them. I think at this point it's important to acknowledge that the Ministerial Council on Drug Strategy has recently released the National Corrections Drug Strategy, which unequivocally supports the approach of harm minimisation. That's a balance between demand, supply and harm reduction. However, although the strategy acknowledges the high level of hepatitis C in prisons, estimating that it's 17 times greater than in the general community, it balks at the challenge of providing equity of service in correctional settings, and I quote, "Some community harm minimisation practices are incongruent with contemporary practices or public expectation." I'll get back to that further on. The 2004 National Prison Entrance BBV Bloodborne Virus Survey showed that among people entering prison, 34% have the hepatitis C antibody. Among those entering prison with a history of injecting drug use, 56% were antibody positive. HIV prevalence was low among the 612 people surveyed. Three tested positive. But we will only see a HIV explosion in Australian prisons or in Australia in retrospect. That's certainly been the experience overseas. It goes like wildfire when it goes, and as occurred in Vancouver, a city not dissimilar in many ways to Australian cities, it was a good 6 months before they really cottoned on, and the key reason was the dynamism of the drug market and health professionals being unwilling to provide adequate access to sterile injecting equipment. Tony Butler and colleagues, in their study of New South Wales prisoners, showed that high numbers of prisoners are actually contracting Hep C while in prison, and mostly through sharing contaminated injecting equipment. The 2001 Inmate Health Survey in New South Wales showed that among inmates with history of injecting in prison, 72% of women and 67% of men had used injecting equipment after someone else. About a third of them stated that the needle had been used by five or more people before them. Yet it would seem that the best way to respond to these very alarming figures is to make sure that drugs are prevented from entering the prison system. But in the absence of complementary measures to ensure that those who are using drugs in prison have the means to protect themselves from bloodborne virus infection, it's too simple and bound to fail. For many of you, I know this is not new. Many in the health sector are well aware that prison environments are, as Father Peter Norden from Jesuit Social Services says, they're not a healthy place. The level of mental health, the level of social disadvantage, of illiteracy is, of course, well known to all of us. But where does it go in terms of international principles? Why, in Australia, as a leading nation in the development of the United Nations, are we not resonating with the basic principles for the treatment of prisoners declared in 1990? Is that legible? It's become commonly known as the principle of equivalence. Based on this principle, the World Health Organization, UNAIDS and the United Nations Office of Drug Control in their papers state that the higher prevalence of injecting drug use and associated risk behaviour in prison... The higher the prevalence of injecting drug use and associated risk behaviour is in prison, the more urgent introduction of prison-based needle and syringe programs become. Where does that leave our National Corrections Drug Strategy? If you dig deep down into the appendix of the National Drug Strategy, Appendix B, you can read that correctional facilities are environments that concentrate on a subset of the population who are experiencing higher than normal levels of impairment in multiple domains, including drug problems. This presents a unique opportunity to address the range of problems facing this population that does not adequately access healthcare in the community. Some significant challenges that may present include, and a number of challenges are identified, including unsafe injecting practices and bloodborne virus transmission, followed by an acknowledgement of the difficulty of providing equity of services in these environments when some community harm minimisation practices are incongruent with contemporary practices or public perception. I'm not a great reader of government documents, but, you know, to be perfectly frank, it does sound like weasel words to me. It sounds like there's an acknowledgement of a problem, that there's a clear solution to the problem, that we've learnt from our experience in the community, but the responsibility that governments hold is being addended in Appendix B. I've already mentioned the UN Basic Principles for the Treatment of Prisoners. I've also mentioned the principle of equivalence. I think there's another layer of law that should guide us, and that is that at the common law, prison authorities owe a duty of care to prisoners to protect them from foreseeable harm while in custody. I'm no lawyer, and I'm glad that we've got a lawyer, but logic would suggest that the two principles combine to make a convincing case for the provision of NSPs in prison. There are more documents. I don't challenge anybody to read that, but I'll quote from it. It's the Revised Standard Guidelines for Corrections in Australia, endorsed by the Australian Corrections Ministers in 2004. These guidelines have been developed in accordance with the principle that prisoners are treated with respect as human beings, owed a duty of care by the administering department, and further, prisons should identify, minimise and manage risk. Prisons should provide for the personal safety of staff and prisoners by ensuring a prison environment that protects the physical, psychological and emotional well-being of individuals. Prisons should develop and implement a prisoner safety regime which identifies prisoners at risk and places prisoners in situations which minimise their opportunities to be harmed or harm others. All necessary measures should be taken to ensure that no prisoner injuries or unnatural deaths occur. Prisons should provide a management system that meets the different and particular needs of all prisoners, including at-risk prisoners. In relation to implementing NSPs in prison, yes, it may be difficult to do so, but doing so is arguably consistent with the responsibility of governments and prison authorities. It's a cliche, but I think it's important. People go to prison as punishment, not for punishment. So far, I've spoken of the very real need for NSPs in prison as a means to manage and respond to the harms associated with injecting drug use. I've also mentioned the principle of equivalence and how the current situation in prison is out of step with what is available in the community. Debates and discussions about NSP in prison have largely focused on the preventative aspect in relation to bloodborne virus transmission among prisoners tackled as a health issue, at least from the health side of the table. From the perspective of prison officers, though, the issue is often not one that has to do with health. It's an issue about safety. One of the most common arguments against the implementation of NSPs in prison is that syringes will be used as weapons. To use the words of a prison officer representing the prison officer's vocational branch in New South Wales and quoted in the Australian Doctor, needles are weapons and we don't want to deal with more weapons in the prison system. The frequency and likelihood of this occurring in the Australian context is of course up for discussion before the introduction of a prison-based needle and syringe program, and I don't think any firm decisions about NSPs in prison ought to be made until we can get some clarity on this point. But internationally, NSPs in prisons have been operating for at least 10 years now in other countries, including Switzerland, Germany, Spain, Moldova, Kyrgyzstan and Belarus. The international experience shows that the introduction of prison-regulated and controlled NSPs have not ever resulted in instances of syringes being used as weapons. In fact, international experience shows that prison-regulated and controlled NSPs actually increase institutional safety. But these are facts and dissociated from the day-to-day conditions under which staff in prisons work. In preparing for this talk, I came upon an article by a representative of the New South Wales Prison Officers Union from the early 90s. In discussing the management of HIV in prisons, he writes, "Every time officers enter jail, they do not know whether or not they walk out again at the end of the shift. Prisons are unpredictable places. Calmness may exist 1 minute, and in the next, unbelievable scenes of violence and destruction erupt." A New South Wales parliamentarian in 91 describes the prison environment in the following way: "Gross overcrowding in our prisons and the number of people now being held in our prisons as a result of the so-called truth in sentencing policy are leading to much higher rates of aggression and much higher rates of prisoner use of drugs because of the total alienation felt by many prisoners. Indeed, since 91, the numbers of people in prison, including unsentenced and people held on remand, has increased significantly." The New South Wales parliamentarian was making her observation during the debates on the introduction in New South Wales of the Prison Syringe Prohibition Amendment Bill, which was passed by the New South Wales Parliament following the well-known Geoffrey Pierce case, where a correctional officer was stabbed by a syringe. Geoffrey Pierce was 22 years old and had been working, still on probation, had been working for only 3 months. It's a pretty horrendous story because he was escorting a prisoner who had significant mental health issues. He was escorting a prisoner to the exercise yard and was stabbed in the what's called the buttocks. The prisoner was HIV positive and mentally ill, and later died of AIDS, as did Geoffrey Pierce. They both died in 1997, and it's actually a terrible story. It obviously occurred in an environment where there was no prison-based needle and syringe program, but in an environment where needles are in the prison system. And I can understand why that case is often used as a stalking horse for rejecting prison-based NSPs. The risk of aggression, the risk of in an overcrowded and volatile environment is not a nice place to work. Yet we know that needles and syringes find their way into the prison system despite current efforts to keep them out. Figures are not publicly available. Sorry, I should have flicked to that, which is also illegible. I should say that the prison officer was the ninth, I think the eighth person to die in a New South Wales correction facility officer since 1869. They were all basically died violent deaths, usually by bashing, and Geoffrey Pierce was the second last one. Nonetheless, needles and syringes are still getting into prison. The figures are not publicly available for the most part. In fact, finding good figures out of the prison correction system in Australia is a very difficult task that I was unable to succeed at. However, a National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre study of 2006 found that among 163 prison officers surveyed in Victoria and Western Australia, 66% reported finding syringes in prison. A prison officer from the union in New South Wales said that the possibility of a direct assault on an officer with a blood-filled syringe is one that will always be there. So is the problem of getting killed with an iron bar or a length of wood. An article in the Sydney Morning Herald showed that most prison officer deaths occurred as a consequence of sustained injuries. Needles are already in circulation in the prison system. The threat is not new. The threat of violence is not new. And, of course, the most preferred weapon is not a needle. The most preferred weapon is blocks of wood or sharp instruments like knives, or, in fact, bare hands. But, as I've mentioned earlier, the international experience shows that the introduction of prison-regulated and controlled NSPs has not resulted in instances of syringes being used as weapons. How do I get rid of that? Peter Farr, who's the warden at the prison in Switzerland, which became the first to introduce prison NSP in 1992, said in 1996 that staff have realised that distribution of sterile injecting equipment is in their own interest. They feel safer now than before the distribution started. 3 years ago, they were always afraid of sticking themselves with a hidden needle during cell searches. No staff has suffered needle stick injuries since 1993. In fact, in Germany, when decisions were made to close the NSP in prison due to the change in the political regime, staff were the most vocal critics of the government's decision. Prison staff started a petition to lobby for the reinstatement of the needle and syringe program. According to the Canadian HIV Legal AIDS Network, in Lichtenberg, a prison in Berlin, prison staff, 85% who opposed the initial introduction of the needle exchange program in 1998, were among the main actors lobbying the government to keep the program operating. Quite apart from the moral and ethical considerations of extending humane treatment to fellow human beings, I would think that occupational health and safety considerations also have a role to play. Not only does it reduce the incidence of needle stick injuries, we know where they're located, how many needles are located within a prison, where they're located and how they'll be stored. It becomes a question of regulation, and that regulation can improve workplace safety for prison officers compared to an environment where, as now, they count as contraband and are hidden in what prisoners would deem to be the most unlikely of places. In 2006, the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre survey of 163 prison officers in Victoria and WA, about 10% indicated that they had ever sustained a needle stick injury. This commonly occurred in the course of searching inmates and cells, but a third indicated that this occurred during routine duties other than searching. A model for prison-regulated and controlled NSPs that has been employed overseas involves prisoners being required to keep their kit in a predetermined place in their cells. Since the needles are part of an approved program within the prison, there is no need for the offender to conceal the needles for fear of being punished. In Spain, retractable needles and syringes sets are provided along with a disposal container wherein the prisoners are required to store their used equipment. It is not an offence to possess prison-issued needle and syringe sets, but it is an offence to have used equipment outside of the container. The National Corrections Drug Strategy defines the difficulty of implementing harm minimisation strategies such as NSPs as possibly being incongruent with contemporary practice in prison settings. In fact, regulation and control are hallmarks of the prison setting and prison system. The introduction of prison-regulated and controlled NSP, as occurs in other jurisdictions in the world, would not logically be at odds with current practice. I think it's important to stress this. Prison-regulated and controlled NSPs. As in the community, drug use remains illegal. In the community, the distribution of sterile injecting equipment is regulated, controlled and restricted to specific classes of persons. In most states, this would be pharmacists and their assistants and duly authorised and approved needle and syringe programs. The introduction of prison-regulated and controlled NSP would also be consistent with OHS legislation. As indicated earlier, the National Occupational and Health Safety Strategy that goes to 2002 articulates the shared vision of all Australian jurisdictions that work-related death, injury and disease are not inevitable but can be prevented. In all jurisdictions, employers must provide safe and healthy workplaces and safe systems of work. In the ACT, the relevant onus is phrased in the following way. An employer shall take all reasonable, practicable steps to protect the health, safety and welfare at work of the employer's employees. This means providing and maintaining a working environment that is safe for the employer's employees and without risk to their health. Without risk to their health. What is reasonable and practicable? I will have to let the lawyers argue that out, but here are the facts as I see it. Out of 163 prison officers surveyed, 16 had suffered a needle stick injury. There's been one case of a needle being used as a weapon in an Australian setting, and there have been no cases of syringes being used as a weapon internationally. Prison officers are employed on starting salaries that are on average below those for other comparable occupations such as police, firemen, ambulance officers and probation and parole officers. Aside from sudden eruptions of violence and destruction, they constantly risk needle stick injuries when conducting inmate and cell searches with very real risks of hepatitis C infection, particularly given the prevalence among prisoners. So while the easy and obvious solution to contraband in prison is more stringent approaches through more vigorous searches, prison officers are then put at more risk, not knowing when or where they might be stabbed by contraband needles. I'm no statistician, but I would assume that just going by the numbers, the more frequent and the more searches are conducted, the higher probability of being stabbed by contraband needles. Management of contraband in prisons is part of the prison routine. After all, as stated by the Victorian Ombudsman in his recent report, the availability of contraband contributes to a weakening of good governance within a prison and undermines the aims of making a prison environment safe and secure. But should the risk of sustaining a needle stick injury with the attendant trauma that comes with it be considered part and parcel of doing a prison officer's job? I don't think so. Prison needle and syringe supply is unregulated and uncontrolled. Prison officers risk sustaining needle stick injuries when conducting searches and in general duties. We're not talking about the sterile needles and syringes supplied through community-based NSPs. We're talking about contraband items, items that are smuggled into prison. This is how the Australian doctor describes it. The blanket prohibition has made syringes a scarce, high-value commodity in prison. Needles are routinely shared, sometimes between as many as 100 inmates. When blunt, it's not unheard of for them to be sharpened on prison walls. Given the blanket prohibition, it's not unusual for inmates to construct needles and syringes from other available materials. Because it's contraband and illegal to possess needle and syringe programs, these have to be really well hidden to devoid attention. We're talking about needle stick injuries from used, blunt, makeshift needles and syringes hidden in all sorts of places, some of which may well not only contain BBVs but other infections. And I'm sure if anyone works here in the prison system or has been in prison, they'd be aware of all of the slang. I'm not, but I do recall one bit of slang from listening to a prisoner, which was in the box, which is basically, how would you say it in a nice way, rectal insertion of bits and pieces up your bum. for trafficking. And that's in fact how some needles get into jail. So the risk of infection for prison officers is a serious issue. What then is the responsibility of government that's reasonable and practical? Increased surveillance and control to prevent contraband needles and syringes from entering prisons just on its own, or in conjunction with prison-regulated and controlled NSPs where there is greater likelihood that needles and syringes are sterile, are kept in safe disposal containers at all times when not used, and are safely disposed of once they are used. One of the priorities of the National Occupational and Health and Safety Strategy is the reduction of high incidence or severity risks. The revised standard guidelines for corrections in Australia says under the safe environments and the effective management of risks area that prisons should identify, minimise and manage risk. Prisons should provide for the personal safety of staff and prisoners by ensuring prison environment that protects the physical, psychological and emotional well-being of individuals. Prisons should develop and implement a prisoner safety regime which identifies prisoners who present a risk and places prisoners in situations which minimise their opportunities to be harmed or harm others. Based on this analysis, the introduction of prison-regulated and controlled NSPs would arguably be consistent with efforts to cultivate safer environments and effective management of risks. It would be consistent with efforts to comply OH&S principles as well as the standards for corrections in Australia. Prison-regulated and controlled NSPs can be of benefit to prison officers. Prisoner health and workplace safety issues for prison officers do not need to be mutually exclusive. While doing some reading for this talk, I came upon a quote by a prison officer in an article in the Australian Doctor, speaking about the possible introduction of prison-based NSPs. And I apologise for people with delicate ears, but the quote was thus in Australian Doctor, so I'll say it here, and we are in a free country. No fucking way. No. If they introduce anything like that, then we are out on strike. I don't care about fucking Spain. Go and commit crime in Spain if that is what you want. Why? Despite the evidence, NSPs and drug use continue to be sensitive topics in our community. But what is the message for prison officers? Go work in Spain if you want to serve a safer workplace. The role of prison officers has and continues to evolve, and it's not only about surveillance, security and control, but now includes human elements as well. The National Corrections Services Training Package, which is a national industry-endorsed competency standards for people working in the correction fields, includes competencies that relate to security and management, occupational health and safety, as well as the human elements of working with people. Competencies include maintain the health, safety and welfare of offenders, respond to offenders influenced by drugs or alcohol, protect the safety and welfare of vulnerable offenders, protect the safety and welfare of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander offenders, and undertake case management. These are entry-level electives for assuming full custodial roles. Occupational health and safety and acknowledging the extent of drug use is clearly part of the minimum standards for officers. The National Drug Strategy is quite clear on this issue. Governments do not condone illegal risk behaviour such as injecting drug use. They acknowledge that these behaviours occur and that they have a responsibility to develop and implement public health and law enforcement measures designed to reduce harm that such behaviours can cause. In an environment where drug use is prohibited, supplying sterile needles and syringes may seem like a contradiction. NSPs are but one element of a comprehensive package of strategies to address drug use issues in the community. It's not the only strategy. Similarly, in the prison environment, the introduction of prison-regulated and controlled NSP would be a part of a package of strategies to create a safer environment for both prisoners and prison staff. Change is required amongst officers in their attitudes and value judgments about these issues. The National Drug Law Enforcement Research Fund released in 2004, a monograph by Catherine Spooner and colleagues on the role of police in preventing and minimising illicit drug use and its harms. There are some parallels here, I think, given that prison officers, like police, are enforcers of law, regulations and order. Additionally, there are similar drug-related issues that police might encounter in the course of their routine work, including violence, needle-stick injuries and corruption. Just like prison officers, the role of police has continued to evolve and continues to change. For example, the traditional view of policing as, in the words of Spooner and colleagues, reactive, non-collaborative and reliant upon coercive strategies, to new collaborative and proactive models such as community policing and problem-oriented policing, which is focused on identifying and solving problems using a partnership approach to respond. The police were and still are one of the strongest supporters of NSPs in the community in Australia. They've long acknowledged the public health benefits that NSPs contribute in preventing the spread of bloodborne viruses and thereby protecting the community. New South Wales Police Superintendent Frank Hanson, who I think is the current chair of the Intergovernmental Committee on Drugs, was interviewed for the Annex Bulletin a few years ago and had this to say: policing that is done in a balanced and constructive way can contribute to better public health programs. It's not our core business. We advocate for public health, and a lot of the time the police have been ahead of public opinion on many things, including needle and syringe programs. We're not social workers, but there is a role there. I think there's a lot of learning from the way that police have shown leadership in relation to handling health consequences and risk associated with illicit drug use. And I think prison officers really owe it to themselves to look to the police for an exemplar of how to manage these issues, and also to demand, I think, that their own occupational health and safety is threatened by the current environment of deregulated, unenforced, beyond control NSP, informal NSP, that is the current Australian prison-based needle and syringe program. And as prison officers move into the 21st century, significantly changed from the way they were at the beginning of the 20th century, let alone the 19th century, I think tradition is grand, but really, if the tradition is broke, as John Howard didn't say, I think we should fix it. Thank you.